there, and a warm and happy welcome. My name is Katja Diehl, and every 2 weeks I invite people who have a look with me normally on the transformation of mobility in an intersectional approach. But today I'm happy to have a chat with a sister from another mister, with Amy Diehl. Amy and I stumbled upon each other via social media, which is always nice when you recognize that there's, again, social in social media. Sometimes it's a bit far away, but we met and we chatted and we had like a same approach to see what kind of lack we have. Also in the world of mobility, of course, it's a lack of diversity, it's a lack of different approaches, it's a lack of seeing what is needed for the change. So I was glad enough to talk to Amy, who is a best-selling author also and a researcher for intersectionality in a more like meta approach. And we are looking upon all the difficulties we have, especially, of course, in a world where we have people like Donald Trump and others who are not so interested, to say it politely, to change the world for the better. There is a lack of going forward. Sometimes I feel like I'm living in a really crash of what we already approached. But Amy is really positive. Amy is looking forward. Amy is looking as a researcher. Where are the points? Where can we go further forward in the future where everyone is living a good life and not just a privileged, white, old cis man? So if you like this episode, feel free to share it with others. Feel free to look at Amy's and my website. And now I wish you a really nice listening to our chat and very, very much experience of what is needed for a better future. Enjoy. And with this episode, we hop to another part of the world. I'm right now at my sofa in Hamburg, and I have Amy on my side with the same name, last name. I would like to ask you to introduce yourself a bit.
Yeah, hi, I'm Dr. Amy Diehl, same last name. I feel like I've just met my long-lost cousin from Germany. But I am Dr. Amy Diehl. I am a chief information officer at a small college in Pennsylvania in the United States. And I'm also a gender equity researcher, speaker, consultant. And I am the co-author of a book. It's called Glass Walls, Shattering the Six Gender Bias Barriers Still Holding Women Back at Work. Yeah. And so while I work in IT and I love IT, my passion is gender equality and really equality for all people, but I'm focusing on equality for women.
Mm-hmm. And it's also really nice that you have this approach to IT, because I just talked yesterday about the biases we need to avoid when we have like software system, when we have like also like autonomous driving, where some of the cars can't see, so to say, children, because they see them as whatever that means. So maybe this is a nice first step. How is this coming together in your work? Is it also like an eye opener to have like equity and IT both in your passion?
Oh, for sure. So within the IT realm, you know, of course it's male dominated, and you know, you think about the people who are writing the software, young, and I think in the United States context, it's usually young white men or young Asian men who are the workers, you know, creating the software, and the ones who are rising up through the ranks and making the decisions. And so when you have so few women, there are women there, but when there's so few women at the table, it can be hard for their voices to be heard. So when they make, let's say a woman makes a suggestion about a piece of software to say, hey, you know, I think women might experience it in this way. sometimes they have their, you know, if they're overridden by the majority of the people in the room, they're like, oh, you know, their ideas might likely be dismissed. And so, like you were talking about the autonomous software, you know, maybe having more women on the groups that are making the software that is, you know, create that is allowing the autonomy and the driverless cars, maybe that would help them to think about women's experiences, pregnant women's experiences, children, help them think about other groups. And then certainly there are other marginalized groups that come into play. And it's, you know, not just the driverless cars, but for all types of software, like people who have disabilities, people who have different, you know, racial backgrounds, any kind of difference really needs to be brought into the thinking and the design of software. So that's how I think about it in IT. Like what we're doing, we really want to, as an industry, IT, we want to design systems and software and hardware and things that are useful for all people. And so we need to have all people, a diverse representation of people who are included in the conversation and whose perspectives are heard and taken seriously and acted upon. We need to have them all at the table.
Yeah. And I our talk right now is a bit linked to another talk and another episode of She Drives Mobility. And there were Herr and Speer, which is really a nice part of last names. They wrote a book, When the Last Woman is Leaving the Room, the men who have been like feminists, the door is closing and they stop to being like feminist. And you told me, as we talked before, that you are now more like into equity. Would you like to explain why you have this kind of topic more in your focus?
Yeah, so my co-author and I, Dr. Leanne Dubinsky, when we first met, you know, we were talking about our shared perspectives and our shared values and how we were both feminists. We believed in equality for men and women. But we wanted to think about it. We decided we both wanted to think about it more broadly. And so we coined this term called equalists. And so we consider ourselves to be equalists, which means equality for all people, no matter who you are. Certainly man, woman, but then thinking about other identity characteristics that people have, no matter what race they are, no matter what their health status is, no matter what age they are, we value all people. We believe in equal opportunities and equal freedom and equal rights for all people. And so that's the perspective from which we come from while we study, where our focus, my research focus is women.
Mm-hmm. And what was really nice for me to read, we can come to this kind of 6 points you are having in your book and your actual book, because it's really, yeah, reminds me of my, so to say, fight for intersectional mobility approach, because it's about privileges. And privileges so often feel like I have the right to, because people are used to, they don't see themselves as privileged, because also like some female authors have said before, a white male abled man can go like everywhere because the world is built for him, and also the mobility is built for him. And it's starting with care work for children or elderly. You have more like not the driving to the job and back. You have like steps you are doing with your mobility. You have more like a network that you are reaching to. So how do you see this kind of male privilege, and how do you try to make it seen, so to say?
Yeah, so I'll talk about it in the context of my book, Glass Walls. So we, with Glass Walls, Dr. Dubinsky and I identified the core 6 glass walls, or the core 6 barriers that make up this concept of gender bias. And the very first one is this concept of male privilege, which you mentioned. So our research is on the workplace environment. So what we say is, you know, male privilege, it dominates the workplace environment. The workplaces were made by men, for men, able-bodied men, white men, typically, to meet their needs without thought of other groups, or and with no thought of other marginalized groups, for example. So it's we find the workplace is a very male culture. A boys' club is a typical term that you'll hear used, where, you know, the topics and the things that people talk about, reflect male interests, and, you know, female or women's interests are kind of are marginalized. It includes things like I mentioned earlier, the concept of tokenism, where you've got one woman or maybe two women at the leadership table for the sake of the appearance of diversity, but you're not really there to include them. You really don't want their perspectives. You know, you don't want anybody who's going to rock the boat or give you a different perspective. But it looks like, oh, you've hired these couple women. We must be diverse. We must be meeting our, but you're not, if you don't, if you're not really including their voices. And it can be hard. Until women are at least 40 to 50% of the work group, it can be hard for their voices to be heard just because of the statistics, the numbers. So that's the first barrier. And we say that's the bedrock upon which all the other barriers are, they come from. The second one is disproportionate constraints. So women are certainly in the environment. We're in workplaces everywhere, but we find there are disproportionate constraints on our choices and behavior, including on even just the careers that we choose. Certainly, we have more options today than like what my mother did in the 1970s. There's more career choices besides teaching and nursing and secretarial, which were her only choices, and so she chose teaching. But that being said, if you look at labor statistics, what you'll see is that there's still a huge segregation of men and women in jobs, where women are more predominant in the care jobs, which tend to be lower paid, and then men are more predominant in like the engineering, technical, you know, leadership, the roles that are much more highly paid. So while it seems like we do have career choices, all the barriers say to us that we really don't. Another type of constraint is around our voices. Our voices are muted, and they are, we're interrupted in conversations. Our ideas are something that sometimes our ideas are heap-heated. And if you don't know what heap-heated means, that means that when a woman says something in a meeting and it's ignored, and then a man says the same thing and everyone loves it. And so who gets the credit? The man gets the credit, right? And so it's a way that her voice is constrained.
Mm. But what is coming up to my mind, I've been in a corporate situation. I had really like a high working career. I was well paid. And I was working in the male-dominated mobility branch, so to say. And they sent me to courses. It wasn't called like this, but it felt like it. Act more like a man. It was like, be more, have more distance to your people in the team, be more male, reading, like, no, it's sometimes I think it's a bit of a backlash right now, because there are so many things you can read outside. The women have to take the stage. And I'm like, no, that is making the same mistakes again, because mm-hmm. what you pointed out, of course, the jobs in care business are not so good paid, but it's a failure of the system, because it's really, really healing people or nursing. It's really it's a failure that it's more like for the women, but then it's not so good paid. How do you see this? Like, how can we interrupt also this approach to fix the women?
Yeah, so, you know, our book, and we don't take the approach of fix of the women, because because what women find is that when they start acting like the men, they get penalized for it. I found that own pushback in my own career when I was a younger IT leader. I remember watching my male boss. I watched how he led. I tried to be authoritative just like he was authoritative. And I got backlash from my subordinates. They were like, what is she doing? Like, Amy, what are you doing? We don't, you know, I found that I had lost points with them. And that's when I started to realize maybe there was something different between men and women, how we're perceived in the workplace. Because up until that point, I really thought everything was a meritocracy. If I worked hard, I would get the same results as my male counterparts. Once I started studying it, my eyes were open that it's not a meritocracy. But that being said, women and their voices getting dismissed, it's a problem, and we need. So, you know, we talk about their voices, and then you talked about like care work, right? Like, and the devaluing of it from a societal perspective. We need to start valuing care. Like, care work is taking care of our youngest and our oldest and our most vulnerable people in our population. And that is probably harder work than the engineer who sits behind the desk and, you know, solves the engineering problem. Even if it's not harder work, it's a different kind of work and it should be equally valued. This person is contributing to society in one way. This other person is contributing in another way. But the, you know, the person who's contributing by caring for other individuals is helping the growth of society, you know, just the same as somebody who's solving the problem for the, you know, the widget or the car or whatever. And so it's time that we start valuing all work. And I think that some of that has to come from our governments, you know, it's as opposed to like not so much bottom up, but top down. And so we need to be thoughtful about the leaders we're voting for and the people that we're electing and putting into government positions, because I feel like that it's people at the top who can make change. And then beyond the governments, any of the people at the top of the organizations. So if you're an organization and you can run a daycare center, let's say, that would support your employees, well, think about the pay that you're paying those daycare workers. Give them much more than a livable wage, you know, value what they're doing so that then you have quality care for your people who are, you know, who are doing the other work of your, you know, your business.
Mm. And the third ceiling you are writing about in your book is more on support.
Yeah. It's support.
Yeah, it's really interesting for me. How do you see this as a topic we need to fix?
Yeah, so insufficient support is what women often find is they don't have the same supports as men. They don't have mentors. Or they don't have, can be hard to find mentors who are men. It can be hard to find mentors who are women, in particular, if like you're the first woman, you know, who's rising up through a particular role or particular ranks. They often lack sponsors. So sponsor is somebody who's in a position that can advocate for their advancement or put them into, you know, advocate for their promotion or makes a hiring decision or a promotional decision. They're often also excluded from social networks, informal groups. Like in the United States, we've got this culture of people going in some industries, they have a culture of people going out to the golf course, right, on the weekends. And who has time to go out on the golf course on the weekend? Well, a man who's single, unencumbered, or a man who's got a wife that's taking care of his children, their children at home. And so what we find is that women, as far as like the informal networks, women often find they don't have time or they don't have the interest. Not everybody likes golf. Not everybody's a golfer. It tends to be a more masculine endeavor. There's some women that like golf. That's great. But the problem isn't necessarily that the men are out on the golf course on the weekend, like, you know, having camaraderie and everything. The problem is when business decisions are being made and the decisions to choose who's being hired and promoted are made based on those golf course conversations. You know, and the solution to that is that the men, the people in those contexts, need to say, okay, if you're going to start to talk about work on the golf course, hey, let's wait, let's table this. Let's wait till Monday when we can bring in Jane and Jill and all the, you know, the other people who need to be around the table. So then we can have all the stakeholders around the table and talk about that work decision. And they also need to be careful not to privilege the men, their male counterparts who are out on the golf course with them when they're thinking about hiring decisions. They need to think about all the people in the workplace, who's getting the work done, right? And you know, and instead of just hiring the people from the bro network or their buddies. So the solutions for exclusion aren't necessarily to make sure that, you know, that women are invited to the drinking events after work, you know, going to the bar, or that women are invited to. I mean, certainly, if you're having those events, you know, it should be inclusive, but just make sure that the work decisions are not being made there.
And speaking about your research and your book, do women see this, or do they also need your help to make it seen? What do you see when you talk about this stuff with women? Are they like, oh, wow, that's exactly what is in my job, but I didn't see it as a problem?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I find. And I've yet to come across a person who has not experienced some aspects of bias and who, after listening to my talk or reading my book, who hasn't said, most women are like, check, check, check. Unfortunately, are like, check, 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 check. I've experienced so many of these. But I've yet to come across anybody who hasn't experienced any of them, because we, unfortunately, it's a societal problem. It's based on the unfair gender hierarchy that puts men above women. There shouldn't be a gender hierarchy. We're all humans, right? But society has, you know, through history and things, this hierarchy has been created. And so as women, we're a step lower. And so we're treated as such, you know, not just at work, but, you know, like out in society, and you talk about it in terms of your work with mobility, you know, how it impacts us, like when we go out to the grocery store, or when we go out, you know, to make, you know, wherever we're going, when we're traveling, whatever we're doing, you know.
Yeah, it's also in my work, it's also like what you feel being secured, or if you are secure. So it's a feeling. So often it's like about the light in a station or other people around you who are waiting for the bus. And a man sometimes says, I don't know, what is the problem here? It's sometimes when I have a walk my friends, or and they are male, I choose other ways because I know even if it's dark, there is light. And they never thought about this. And I think it's also maybe also seeing the next ceilings you are writing about. There is so much about it, also about communication and telling people and talking about it all.
Yeah. So the next one is devaluation. And that's where women's contributions are valued less than men's. And one clear example is salary inequality, where women are paid less than men. We talked about that in terms of the types of fields that the care work getting paid less than the male-dominated fields. But it also occurs when women are in the same positions or the same types of fields as men.
So and also what we call in Germany the part-time trap.
Yeah.
So that part-time work is sometimes in your life necessary because you're taking care of children or elderly. But it's seen, that is also something I see in the female aspect, that care work is normally not paid. And it cuts you from your job.
Yes.
But it needs to be done. So that's also, I think, a trap sometimes.
Yeah,
it's very familiar.
Yeah. Yeah, and in the United States, if you don't get a paycheck, then you're not contributing to your Social Security, which provides for you after retirement. So, so if you take part-time work or you take time off, then you are no longer contributing to Social Security. And in the United States, there's no like stipend or there's no provision for somebody who's doing care work to give them something towards their Social Security to compensate them for that. And there should be. That's where I talked about the importance of governments being, you know, being on board with, you know, true gender equality. Another type of devaluation that I thought we should talk about is credibility deficit. And that's where women's words are not believed or not deemed as credible as men's. And the example I give is if you've ever been in a meeting or you've ever been in a situation where you've said something and the man next to you says, "Are you sure that's right?" Or if they look to the man, if you make a statement and they look to the man next to you to say, "John, is she right about that?" Like, that's credibility deficit. You know, you're as the speaker or the woman, you're like, "I wouldn't have said it if I didn't think it was right." but it's really this idea that women's words are not as credible as men's, that they don't have the experience, the expertise, you know, the whatever. And so it puts a question around their statements. And I think it's something you and I were talking about with, you know, even when men who advocate for gender equality, and we need men to advocate for gender equality, but sometimes their voices are privileged over the women who are saying the exact same thing.
The examples you're bringing out, for me, they are yelling insecurity. So is it also, when we look about all those effects you're bringing, is it also to have in mind what it means to be privileged and what it means to be, there are now other voices at the table, because some researchers explain the right-wing backlash also with this kind of diversity, with this kind of LGBTQA, that it's also meaning a kind of insecurity for, like, what is in my approach, petro-masculinity. It's more like having a huge car which sucks not energy from the sun. Yeah, is it also a bit of when we are on the table as females and they are talking about us and you're waving like, hey, I'm here, you can talk to me. Is it also like insecurity or what are the reasons?
I think you hit on it with the privilege thing, because privilege is most hidden to the people who have it. Mm-hmm. Like you often don't see it, you know, and until it's like kind of brought to you, either through your own research or because maybe somebody, you know, calls it out. Like you may not see it, you know, and I think in some ways, most people have privilege in some category or another. The example for that is a white able-bodied man has a privilege in a lot of categories, right? Especially a wealthy one. But someone like myself, I'm a white female. So the female category, maybe I'm not privileged, but certainly the white female, right? Over my sisters, other women who are not, you know, who are of other races or ethnicities. And so, you know, that's something in my own work that I've had to say, yeah, like, just understand it. It's kind of this intersectional thing going on where we all have privilege. Most of us have some privilege, some categories of privilege and some of not privilege. But the point is that we need to recognize in ourselves, like, where am I privileged and where am I not? And so that when we are to recognize when we are privileged, then to think about, okay, not everybody has the same experience as me. And how do I make sure their voices are heard? Their voices are deemed credible. Their voices are supported. Their voices are, you know, truly at the table, rather than it just being me, you know, trying to explain what their needs or perspectives may be.
And we have so much work done, as we felt like it, like Me Too, mm-hmm. like other, where women speak out and sometimes it's like in ways that we think now we are more like concerned about what is happening, but the feeling in some work areas is really not being safe, not being secured, not being in a safe space. That is the fifth part of your glass ceilings, and it's really set to see that is still a topic.
The hostility. So the fifth wall is hostility, and that's the really overt discrimination and harassment. These things are used to keep women in their supposed place, to keep them in line, Sometimes when hostility happens, it's from men. Often it's from men, but sometimes it's from women. And so female hostility fits into this category. And in our book, we talk about two types. One is called Queen Bee behavior, and the other is called Mean Girls behavior. So the difference is Queen Bee is when a woman who's in a higher position blocks opportunities for a woman in a lower position or harasses her. And the Mean Girls is when it's women who are peers. The thing to remember about that is that we're all socialized into the same system. And when women come into the workplace and it's a male-normed workplace and it's a male culture, they're learning also how to live and survive in that culture. The queen bee phenomenon happens because whenever women are made to feel insecure, like there's only room for one, there's only room for a select few. And if you lose your position, you know, someone else behind you, they'll come along and take it. We can put another woman in. And the only way that can happen is if you lose out. So women become insecure. When they feel insecure, then they may exhibit this hostility towards other women. And the thing about female hostility is that I think that it's not the norm. Like, I think that most women are generally supportive of other women. But when it happens, it always feels unexpected, and we're always surprised by it, and always more. It feels more hurtful.
The cup is more deeper.
Yeah, exactly. Because we expect solidarity from our other women, and when we don't get that, it hurts much worse. So I think that's why, so something to keep in mind that most women are supportive and do seek out your supportive female colleagues. But know that if it is somebody who is exhibiting these behaviors, they're likely deeply insecure. And the tip I always say is try to form a relationship with them. Try to, you know, get to know them on a personal level. Try to share your vision and your goal of having, you know, working together mutually for the good of the organization. If it's your coworker, for example, you know, to try to establish a connection with that person. That can be very hard, you know, and I've certainly dealt with this in my own career, and it can be very hard and sort of intimidating, especially if the person is more senior to you. But that's also where I say build your support network, make sure you've got supportive men and women around you so that like you're not dependent on just this one relationship.
Yeah. And it starts out with like TV formats here in Germany, Heidi Klum, Germany's Next Top Model, where there's always the sequence where hairs are cut, where they change their outlook when they tell them you are not skinny enough. And women are seeing this as a guilty pleasure, and it's really disturbing me that you can enjoy such media formats. But sometimes I think it's also a coping mechanism, because you can rely back on the couch and you can say all the girls know what this kind of format is about. And sometimes it's also here's an NGO having research about women in on screen, and that they are always the caretakers, that they are always like, and when there's a single dad, he's always the hero, and the single mom is always a sad part, and when she's finding her love, she's now getting back to life. So I think it's everywhere, and sometimes for me, what you told, being supportive, I think it's also about having a balancing approach, because sometimes people don't want to see. So if you're trying to get the connection and you don't get it because the person is insecure, and that it's like sometimes this pick me girl, yeah, because it's like strengthening yourself to be like easy peasy, and the guys are saying, oh, she's so good, and you're always like complicated, and but. That is, now we have 5 points, and now we are coming to the point where women might say, I don't want it anymore. It's too much. I have to do so much power in it. And that's also where you shed a light on. No?
Yeah. So the last one is acquiescence. And it's really a combination of all the other barriers. Women may feel one of two things. One, they may have internalized the barriers and feel that they're not confident, that they don't have what it takes. We call that a psychological glass ceiling. Or they may recognize that they do have what it takes, but they just don't want the hassle. Like they don't want to have to deal with all of the hassles. That's the nice word for it. That all the things that their male counterparts don't have to face, right? And they're like, it would just be easier if I stay in my current role, if I stay where I'm at, or if I quit work and, you know, retire early, or, you know, whatever the thing is, because me saying this about either one of these cases of people who feel like they need to acquiesce, it is not pointing the finger at those people or blaming them for making a poor decision. They're making the decision that is a rational choice for their own sanity, their own physical health, their mental health, their emotional health. And the thing that we need to do is, as a society and as organizational leaders, is fix our organization so that women don't have to make this choice, that women can choose to have whatever aspiration they want to have, to do whatever gives them the most fulfillment and the most passion, and have the same opportunities as their male counterparts. Because it's really, I mean, the woman loses out if she doesn't have those opportunities, but it's really the organization and society that loses if you are constraining half of your population, constraining the options and the choices for half of your population in terms of their ability to contribute to whatever goal your organization is trying to solve, or whatever societal good, you know, is we're trying to produce.
So you told me as we come to the end that you already have another research project.
Yes, I do.
And it's also like a passion, or?
Yeah. So our next book, Dr. Dubinsky and I, we're currently working on our next book. It's called Excuses, Shattering the six Myths, Why Women Are Never Quite Right, and What We Can Do to Shatter Them. What these excuses revolve around are all the identity-based characteristics for which women they find themselves being criticized for or running into obstacles. And so an example of one is the one you just mentioned with Heidi Klum and the Next Top Model show, where you said the women are criticized for being too skinny or not skinny enough, right? What we found with our research is often there is no sweet spot for a woman. Like, she's told that she's too young, and then she gets to the age in the 40s, 50s, all of a sudden she's too old. You know, she's not the right, she's not able-bodied, she's not pretty enough, she's too overweight, she does not wearing the right clothing. Like, there's just all these excuses. And what it all boils down to is that she's a woman in the workplace, right? Mm-hmm. And these things are just excuses. They're bogus reasons why a woman may not be a fit. A really common one is that she might get pregnant, maybe baby. That hiring a woman into an organization is a risk because she might get pregnant and need a maternity leave or quit work.
As children come out of the sudden and only women can.
I know, exactly. Whereas her male counterpart, who's like the exact same age and maybe they were both has the same potential to have children. That's the question that's like never asked. Right. Yeah. So that's the next book.
How do you, what is the approach of the book? So you are going also to find really concrete situations where you shed a light what the problem is.
So we've done research and we've collected data from women across it was global data across all industries. I basically had a survey that was open for all women, no matter where you're working. And so we've got women in all countries, and not all countries, but we've got women represented in all continents. We've got women in white collar jobs, blue collar jobs, women, prominent women. We also pull in public stories that are out on the internet, things that are written in the public. So we've got stories of prominent women, and stories of everyday women. And so the goal is to explain and bring to light these excuses to make them really visible. And then we're going to offer solutions for leaders, for workplace allies, and for the women themselves, how we can overcome and eliminate them. But the bringing the things to light, I mean, that's what we do in Glass Walls. We've given names to a lot of things that didn't have names, labels, credibility deficit that I talked about earlier was an example of that. There was no name for that. And so Leanne and I came up with a term, like a label. So now we can talk about it and now we can find a solution. So that's the goal of our work, is to bring these things to light, to make them visible so that women experiencing them can recognize them. Their colleagues in the organization can recognize them, the leaders in the organization, the government officials. So that once we can recognize them, then we can talk about, okay, what can you do in your role to eliminate it, right? Because it'll take all of us. It takes all of us working together. It's a big problem, but it's gender bias is a big problem, but it's a solvable problem. And so that's what we do with the Glass Walls, and that's what we're going to do in the next book, is give lots of solutions and ways that we can eliminate and shatter the biases.
So as the last part of our exchange, maybe to end in a positive way, what are people and companies doing better if they embrace diversity? What does research say about having diversity in teams and in a job environment? What are the possibilities that you can do there?
So the possibilities are, if you have a more diverse workforce, and not just that diverse workforce, but if you are including, you're inclusive, and everybody has a sense of belonging and their voices are heard, if you're really pulling in the perspectives of your diverse workforce, then you're only going to have a better outcome for your customers or whomever it is that you're serving. And I'll give you an example. In the United States, there's a chain. Grocery chain chain of stores called Costco. And Costco has kept their commitments to DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, even with the current backlash of the current government and the current pushback of the current government in the United States. Costco's revenues have only gone up because they've publicly affirmed that they're going to continue to support DEI. And so I read an article recently about that, where one of their leaders basically said, why wouldn't we want to have a diverse workforce? Like, we are trying to serve diverse people, you know, who come into our stores and like they're looking for products and they're looking for, you know, solutions for their everyday lives. We want diverse people making the decisions about what's going into the stores. And so it can only help us. So that's just one example of how, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, like all justice, like all of these things, these fundamental values really help. They help organizations. And they help society.
Mm. Thank you so much for the exchange. Thank you so much to have embraced
me as a former cousin.
We're like a way back cousins, I think.
And I wish you a happy day right now. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Katja.